This message is part of the educational ministry of Columbia International University. We've been preparing world Christians to know Him and to make Him known since 1923.
Thank you very much. I've had a wonderful time yesterday and today. I have some deadlines, so I've had to sort of cloister myself away some of the time. But this morning, I went for a run, and then I walked around, and for me, coming here is going down memory lane. Because when I came in 1971, it was the most pivotal spiritual year of my whole life. And those memories I'll never forget. And so I took some pictures, and one of the students helped me get back to my old dormitory room, which fortunately was occupied by a student who was skipping class. And so he made his bed real quick, and I took some pictures, and my desk was there just the way it was. The room was a little messier, but actually it wasn't. It was as clean as I ever kept it. But I took pictures of my old desk, and I felt like I could just sit down and start working where I left off on a term paper. And it's here that I met my wife as well, and I still know the exact place where I met her for the first time. She was from Maine. Katrina Polvinen was her name. And she spoke with a strong Maine accent. She was a real maniac. And I was from the hills of East Tennessee, and at that time I spoke with a very strong hillbilly brogue. We didn't understand each other for the first 3 years that we dated. I remember the first joke that I ever told her. How's my hand like a lemon pie? The answer is it's got meringue on it. She still hasn't gotten that joke either. But it brings back so many memories for me to be here. And I would like to invite you to check out my website. It's robertjmorgan.com. And I have a blog you can subscribe to for free. In fact, I'm going to post these pictures of that dormitory room and my visit here sometime this week on my blog. But I primarily use it to give sermon outlines or illustrations or stories or devotional insights. And also some books that I've been a part of are on that website. And there's also information, as your president spoke, up here if you'd like to take one of these brochures. It gives you a little bit more information. And you can also go to my website, robertjmorgan.com, and click links there that will allow you to follow along on Facebook or Twitter. And I would just love to stay in touch with you. Now, this week, we are dealing with the first chapters of the book of Exodus in a series of lessons that I'm calling Mosaic, from the Nile to the now. The Lord knows the way through the wilderness. So I'd like to invite you to turn back with me to the book of Exodus in chapter number 1. A couple of weeks ago, or maybe it was last month, I was invited to speak at a large and prestigious church in Southern California. So I was very honored to go. And I flew out on Saturday, and I spoke there on Sunday. And it was wonderful, and it was just one of those experiences that gives you a good jolt of adrenaline. And then on Monday, as I started to come back, my plane left San Diego late. I missed the connecting flight in Dallas. There wasn't anything available till late in the day. I stayed at the airport about all day, took the red eye into Nashville. When I got on, I was so tired, and the gate attendant said, you have enough credits to bump up to first class. And I said, all right, I almost never do that. So I got on first class, we took off, we flew right into a storm. It was loud, and there was a young man sitting beside me, and we couldn't talk a whole lot because it was so loud and so turbulent. But I found out that he was a young man who had just gotten back from his honeymoon and now was going to Nashville to go to Fort Campbell because he was a medic with the Army and he was getting ready to ship off to Afghanistan. And so we talked a little bit. I said, my son-in-law just got back from Iraq, and here's a little book that you may be interested in. And I reached out and gave him one of my smaller books that I'd written, and he thanked me, and I said, you can put this in your backpack, and a lot of soldiers have already taken it, and they seem to enjoy it in situations where they just need some encouragement. So he took me and thanked me, and then he drifted off to sleep. I rested. We got to Nashville, and we went our separate ways. The next morning, in my devotions, this thought came to me so distinctly that perhaps the whole purpose of my trip and God's providence was not speaking at this large and prestigious church. It was just giving this simple piece of literature to an army medic on his way to Afghanistan, and the reason why the Lord orchestrated the whole thing, including the delayed flight and the missed flight and the bumping to first class and the storm and everything else, was just to place me beside this young man and I could give him some literature before he left for the war zone. And in the providence of God, more good may come from that than from many, many sermons that I preach wherever that may be. And the thought has encouraged me many times in my ministry that it's probably not the big things that we do that are the big things. It's the little things that are faithfully, consistently done that makes the biggest difference. And that is so encouraging to me because I don't often have the chance to do big things. We don't often have the chance to do big things. But we have lots of opportunities every single day for little things to be faithfully and consistently done, and that is what makes the difference, and that is what God uses. And I think we have a prime example of that here in the book of Exodus and chapter number 1. So let's begin reading here. Verse 1 through 5 we looked at yesterday. It gives us the names of these 12 scoundrels who were the sons of Jacob, but whom the Lord dealt with so that by the end of the book, by the end of the Bible, their names are the ones inscribed on the gates of New Jerusalem, and it reminds us to never give up on anybody. And now we come to verse number 6. We'll just pick up where we left off yesterday. It says, "Now Joseph and all of his brothers and all of that generation died, but the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly. They were extraordinarily prolific, and they became exceedingly numerous so that the land was filled with them." Now, several generations are encompassed here in verses 6 and 7. We don't know how many. But there was a population explosion. The demographics just absolutely went skyward here with the Israelites. They were very large families. Babies came very quickly. They were very productive. They were multiplying like rabbits. And it says in verse 8, "Then a new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt. 'Look,' he said to his people, 'the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country.' So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithon and Ramesses as the store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied." That can be said for the persecuted church around the world. It's a principle. "But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor and brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. And in all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly." The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Pua, "When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live." This was population control. This was an edict to try to depress the growth of the Israelites. Infanticide. "The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, 'Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?' The midwives answered Pharaoh, 'Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and they give birth before the midwives arrive.' So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own." Then Pharaoh gave this order to all of the people, "Every boy that is born you must throw into the Nile, but every girl, let her live." And then we come to chapter 2, and that sets the stage for the birth of Moses. Now, just cast your eyes over chapter 1, from 1:1 to about 2:1. Look at that. Chapter 1, verse 1, there's, you know, different ways of looking at the dating of Exodus. But let's say that the patriarchs, these 12 sons, live somewhere roughly, let's say in round numbers, around 1800 BC. And let's say that Moses' parents were born and lived somewhere around 1500 BC. Then that means that chapter 1 of Exodus encompasses about 300 years. And if you want to drill down, you can at least say that Exodus chapter 1 gives us 250 years. It is a summary of 250 years of Egyptian and Israeli history, two nations and their parallel stories over a course of a quarter of a millennia. Now, the United States of America is 234 years old at our last 4th of July birthday. So that means you can take the history of the United States and put it down in Exodus chapter 1, and you have room on both ends left over. So this is an extraordinary amount of time encompassed by one particular chapter. Now, let's just talk about the United States of America. I know not all of you are from the United States. This is Columbia International University. But let's say that I was teaching a course here on American history, and you were in that class, and your assignment was, in one page, to give us a summary of American history from the Declaration of Independence to the current day. Just to give a summary. So you might begin by talking about some of the events leading up to the Revolutionary War and about taxation and the Boston Tea Party and all of the things leading up finally to that fateful moment in Philadelphia when the Declaration of Independence was signed in Independence Hall and then the ensuing war and how everything seemed to be going against the colonies until finally Washington crossed the Delaware and with a come-from-behind victory, the colonies won and the United States of America became an independent nation. So you might talk about George Washington, and you might mention John Adams, and then you might talk about Jefferson and the Louisiana Purchase. You might talk about the adopting the Constitution of the United States, and then comes the War of 1812. And then you have a long stretch of time there in which tensions are building and growing towards a boiling point over the issue of slavery and about states' rights. And this division at the Mason-Dixon line between the North and the South until finally there's an eruption in civil war. And there's a man, Abraham Lincoln, and his dramatic assassination at Ford Theater and the ending of the Civil War and U.S. Grant and Reconstruction. And then you come up to the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, you have a period of some prosperity, and then all of a sudden World War I breaks out. And the world is engulfed in a global conflict. You have Woodrow Wilson, you have the League of Nations, you have armistice on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. And then you have a period of prosperity and exuberance that we know of as the Roaring Twenties, leading finally to the Great Depression. And then there's World War II, and there's FDR, and there's the conflict in Europe. And there's the conflict in Asia and in the Pacific theater. And finally, there's the end of World War II and the dropping of the first atomic bomb. You might say something about Harry Truman. And then we have this period of time which we find ourselves mired in Korea and then in Vietnam. More recently, we have the Gulf War. You might mention some of the leaders of the presidents during that time. There's Johnson and there's Nixon. And finally, you come up to the current day and the attack on the World Trade Center on 9/11. And finally, you come to the end of the page and you talk about the election of the first African-American president in American history. And there's your paper, all in one page, a summary of 234 years of American history. Now, what would I think if in your summary of American history, you did not mention the name of one president, one general, one leader, you left all of that out, you didn't put any of the wars in, none of the conflicts. Basically, you gave me one page, which gave me a very vague summary, and you just listed the name of two women somewhere in history who delivered babies. That is the way God writes history. Look at this. It's exactly what Exodus chapter 1 is. This is the way that God doesn't view history the way we do. He doesn't write history the way we do. He gives us 250 years of Israeli and Egyptian history, and the only people that he sees fit to mention, the only people worth putting down in his record, are the name of two women who mop up blood and deliver babies. Now, this is tremendously encouraging to me, because not too many of us are going to do great things. But in God's eyes, the small things are the great things. And in God's eyes, faithfulness and service simply rendered in fear of God and with obedience to his name does more to change history than all of the pharaohs and kings and world leaders put together. And this is the great lesson here of chapter 1. Now, let me say two or three things about these midwives. I don't think they were the only women delivering babies, because there were maybe, who knows, 2 million Israelites. The city I live in, Nashville, isn't that large. We don't have 2 million people in Nashville, and I know how many babies are born every day in those hospitals. And here you had no population control, no birth control. You had proliferation. You had an explosion of the population. So there must have been a whole network of midwives, and maybe Shiphrah and Puah, these two women, were sort of overseeing it. They certainly were the ones who were held accountable by Pharaoh. So I think maybe they were very shrewd businesswomen overseeing a particular service here among the Israelites. But secondly, they were women of great spiritual strength. And they, even though they had been beaten down as a nation for 250 years, even though they were 350 years or so removed from Abraham, they still were faithful to the God of their ancestors, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and they wouldn't flinch in the face of Pharaoh as they stood before their God. It's remarkable to me how many people collapse so quickly today who are Christians. I mean, here we have everything going for us. We've not been oppressed in slavery for 250 years. We grow up in Sunday school. We grow up in church. We grow up with freedom to worship. We grow up memorizing verses. We grow up going to Bible colleges and to international seminaries and universities like this. And sometimes the right temptation can come along. The buddies can say, let's go out and get drunk. Let's go to this club. Let's do that. Some girl will come along. Some guy will come along. Some compromising situation will arise. And it is remarkable how quickly good Christian people collapse. But not these women. They were committed. Are you? They were absolutely dedicated to the God of their fathers. And the third thing is they were very wise and discreet women. Now, there were two reasons why babies were being born so prolifically and the little boys were not being killed. One was because these Hebrew women were vigorous and they gave birth very quickly. The midwives couldn't always get there. The other reason was because even if the midwives got there, they were not going to kill those babies. They were not going to do this. It was wrong in the sight of their God. They had drawn a line there. When they had to give an account to Pharaoh, they mentioned the first one. They didn't mention the second reason, because they were shrewd. They had the wisdom from above. So we can learn a lot about Shiphrah and Puah, the only two people whom God saw fit to mention in 250 years of history. Now, there are three simple lessons that I want to draw out of this. And the first one is that God-fearers are greater than history makers. God-fearers, people who fear God, are greater than history makers. The great people in the eyes of this world are very often small potatoes in God's sight. Now, Israel had a lot of leadership during this time period. I mean, they still existed in their distinctive tribes. They still had some semblance of organization, even in slavery. So there must have been leaders over 250 years among the Israelites. And we certainly know that there were many leaders among the Egyptians, because we can see the pyramids. And you can go to Egypt now and you can see there are nearly 200 pyramids that have been found up to this point in Egypt that have been excavated out of the sands, because all of these pharaohs thought they were so important and so divine that they built these monuments and these tombs to themselves. All of the obelisks, it's remarkable how many obelisks they built in their own honor. You can go to Paris, you can go to London, you can go to Rome, and the oldest things in those towns are Egyptian obelisks that many years ago were brought in during the colonial period. and in some parts of Egypt. It's amazing the reconstructions that you can see in pictures, or if you go there in person, of the great obelisk, all in honor and memory of these great pharaohs who thought they were so important, and the Sphinx. And you can go to Cairo to the Egyptian Museum and see all of the gold that filled the tombs of King Tutankhamun and the other pharaohs. You can go to the British Museum and see the Egyptian antiquities. They all thought they were so important, and they built these monuments to themselves. The Great Pyramids of Giza are the only wonders among the seven ancient wonders of the world that you can still go and see today that are still in existence. God does not even mention one of their names here. I mean, one of the great discussions is, which one was the Pharaoh of the Exodus? Because they were so insignificant in God's sight, he didn't even put their names down. But these two women, Shiphrah and Puah, they were the ones whom God said, these are the real history makers, these are the real eternity changers. I'm going to put their names down in this book. We can all be a Pharaoh or a national leader, but we can all be faithful. The Apostle Paul said, brothers, think of what you were when some of you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. He chose the lowly things of the world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. So if you want to be a world changer, it just means you're a God-fearer. And your name is written down in his history as we are faithful to him, even in small ways. And that brings me to the second thing. God-fearers are known for their humble acts of service. God-fearers are known for their humble acts of service. It's not always the great moments of ministry and the mountaintop experiences that we have. It's those simple things we do every day, faithfully in his name. And there's a very interesting verse I came across the other day that spoke to me in the book of 1 Timothy chapter 5 about widows. Paul was talking to Timothy about the widows to give help to. And he said, no widow may be put on the list of widows unless she is over 60, has been faithful to her husband, and is well known for her good deeds, such as bringing up children. That's listed as a good deed. Showing hospitality, washing the feet of the saints, helping those in trouble, devoting herself to all kinds of good deeds. If we just got busy doing little acts of kindness for one another, I mean, if you made it your goal this week on this campus to see how many simple little quiet acts of kindness you could do for the people around you, this campus would be completely different. And if we all just learned that it is the simple acts of kindness faithfully rendered that makes the difference in God's sight, then what a difference it would make. And it helps us psychologically. It helps us relationally, but it provides the avenues through which God does so much of his great work. And that brings me to the third point. God-fearers pave the way for Jesus Christ to change this world. God-fearers, like Shiphrah and Puah, paved the way for Christ to change this world. They paved the way for Christ to come. Now, think about it in another realm here. From the very beginning, Satan has tried to destroy the messianic line and to keep the Messiah from coming into this world. And I think that's why he prompted Cain to kill Abel, because it was thought that Abel was the progenitor of the Messiah. That's why in the book of Exodus, he had all of the baby boys killed. That's why in the book of Esther, he tried to annihilate all of the Jewish people. That's why in the book of Matthew, he tried desperately by prompting Herod to kill all of the baby boys in Bethlehem. Somewhere among the slaves of Egypt, in Exodus chapter 1, somewhere in the tribe of Judah, there was a man and a woman who had a little baby boy who was in the messianic lineage and who was in the line of ancestry for Jesus Christ. Satan didn't know which child that was. So he tried to annihilate all of the boys, but these two women single-handedly held back the carnage. They feared God, and they defied the king. And the bloodline of the Messiah was spared. And these two midwives, by sparing the bloodline of the Messiah and letting Jesus Christ come into the world, did more to change time and eternity than all of the pharaohs and the kings of Egypt put together who ever ruled, including all of the leaders of Israel. And that's why they're listed here in this particular book, because their simple act of service, it was not fame and fortune. We never need to seek fame and fortune. The Bible says, seek thou great things for thyself, seek it not. It is the simple acts of everyday service faithfully rendered by God-fearers that paves the way for Christ to change this world. I'll give you a closing example. I don't know if you've ever heard of David Brainerd, but maybe you've studied him in some of your classes, you've read biographies of him. Brainerd was born during the colonial times, born in Connecticut. He was orphaned when he was 14 years old. When he was 21 years old, he gave his life to the Lord. He entered Yale University and wanted to study. He criticized his tutor and was expelled. He tried his best to get back into Yale. They wouldn't let him back in. So he developed a burden instead to try to reach the Native Americans. He was in his 20s. Young man, frail, but he had a burden for the Native Americans of New England, and he went out and he tried to live among them. He tried to minister. He tried to preach. He tried to help them. He tried to do benevolent work among them. He tried to take care of their needs. He had very little to show for it, almost no converts, almost no good that was very observable, nothing great in the eyes of men, and he developed tuberculosis and died pathetically at age 29. Jonathan Edwards, the great theologian of America, knew him, studied his life, was deeply impressed with his passion, wrote about him, was so stirred that under his preaching, the Great Awakening arose in America, erupted. It was the greatest revival in American history. It changed America from infidelity to evangelicalism, and the effects of the Great Awakening under Jonathan Edwards and his company, his compatriots, has lasted for 200 years. And in England, a shoe cobbler read the story of David Brainerd, William Carey. He was so deeply impressed by Brainerd's life that he said, I think God is calling me to be a missionary. And he fought and scraped and finally found his support and finally found a support basis. And he went out as the first Protestant missionary in an organized sense. And we call him today the father of the modern missions movement. Henry Martin read David Brainerd's story. And he ended up, another young man who was sickly and in some ways had a very sad story, but he was so inspired by Brainerd that he went out and like a meteor launched the ministry that he had throughout India. In Scotland, a young Scottish pastor who also was sickly, Robert Murray McShane, read Brainerd's story. He was so impressed and inspired and deeply moved that his preaching and his ministry is still being talked about to this day, and he brought revival fires to Scotland. It was Brainerd's story that so impressed Robert Moffat and David Livingstone that they went into the interior of Africa for the cause of Christ. In the 20th century, it was as Jim Elliot read Brainerd's story that he was so moved that he wanted to reach the Alka Indians. And the famous story, I suppose the most famous incident and story in 20th century missions. And today, if you go to Yale University and the great buildings there, there is a building named the Brainerd Building. It is a building named for David Brainerd, the only building on Yale University named for a student that was expelled. Brainerd never knew about any of that. He died at 29, just after a quiet life faithfully rendered. He was just ordinary. I'm an ordinary person. You're in an ordinary school. We go to ordinary churches. We're all just ordinary people. But I think what Shifra and Pua tell us is that there is no telling what God will do with ordinary people who make themselves fully available to His extraordinary grace. That's for you. Shall we pray? Dear Lord, it's mind-boggling to us that in your book you write history in your own unique way. You show us what is really important and what really changes time and eternity. And Lord, somewhere in this room, or somewhere listening to my voice through other means, there is an ordinary person who, under the influence of your extraordinary grace, can do simple things and live a faithful life and change all of eternity in ways that we'll never know about until the end of time when we stand before you. Lord, may this school and these here gathered and me be utterly open to your extraordinary grace and utterly faithful in standing for you and following you and serving you in ways big and small, every hour and every day. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
We hope you were blessed by this message. Additional audio messages and learning resources are available at www.ciu.edu/bookstore or call 803-807-5263. Messages are also available by podcast at iTunes. CIU is a regionally accredited biblical university offering undergraduate and graduate degree programs. Our purpose is to educate people from a biblical worldview to impact the nations with the message of Christ. Thank you for letting us minister to you today.